From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Huge crowds packed the streets of Tehran today for the funeral of Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani. Soleimani was killed in that U.S. drone strike ordered by President Trump at the Baghdad airport on Friday. The U.S. blamed Soleimani for the deaths of thousands of American troops in Iraq and also accused him of plotting new attacks. Iran has promised to retaliate for his killing. Joining us now is one of the only American reporters in Tehran. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly is there. Mary Louise, we've seen these images of the huge crowds filling the streets there today. Tell us more about what you've seen.
Yes, we were out in the middle of those huge crowds for hours today, Jeremy. They were chanting death to America, as they do in Tehran, which you tend to take seriously when you're the only Americans in sight, and people are chanting that at you. But we saw people, many, many people. Iranian state TV is putting the number in the millions. I can't verify that, but certainly many, many, many thousands out carrying long white gladiola stems, out wearing, carrying flags that said everything from deep revenge to down with USA, and many carrying pictures of Soleimani himself, both people carrying them, handheld posters, but then huge billboards that have gone up just over this weekend all over Tehran, all showing pictures of him, some of them showing him embracing the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and all of them depicting him as a martyr and calling for revenge.
And it seemed authentic to you, because we've been speaking today with a Republican congressman who says, you know, we see the images of people very united in Iran in support of the regime there. But, you know, he brought up the fact that it was just weeks ago that people were protesting the government in parts of Iran.
Yeah, and it's a fair point, and there has been discussion of that here, too. I can only speak to what I saw today, which was crowds that would be awfully hard for any government, even an authoritarian regime, to generate. Certainly there are ways of busing people in, getting people out into the streets, but we saw real, raw grief and emotion. People around us sinking to their knees, sitting on the curbs, bending over and sobbing, wailing, beating their chests all around us on the streets today.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, people were saying death to America, and you were one of the only Americans there. Did you feel unsafe in that crowd?
There were moments where it did not feel like the greatest place on earth to be as an American, although in general, people seem to be at pains to emphasize that they are absolutely furious and outraged at America, at the American government, at Donald Trump. Many people wanted us to deliver a message personally to him. We spoke to one man in the crowd who struck up a conversation and said, the message from Iran is kill Mr. Trump, kill the American government. And I said, okay, can you give me your name? And he said, my last name is Soleimani. Everyone in Iran, our last name today and always is Soleimani. We stand with him. So there was great anger. That said, people treated us with respect, and there were others who were decidedly less menacing. One woman told me, I think Trump is worth less than a fly. She said, I don't want to hear from him, but sometimes I think the things he says are quite funny. So there was a range of opinions out there today.
Now, while you were there in the streets, other news, of course, was going on in Iran. The country saying yesterday that it will no longer comply with any limits that were included in the 2015 nuclear deal that the U.S. had already pulled out of. And then there was President Trump's threats about attacking Iran's cultural sites. Did you hear anything about either of those today?
Yes. People reacting very definitely on the streets today to the threats against Iran and further targeting of sites potentially inside Iran itself. We heard from Soleimani's daughter, who spoke at the funeral today, calling for direct attacks on American interests across the Middle East. So people are vowing for revenge. The nuclear deal, as you mentioned, we watch and wait to see what Iran's retaliation will be. They have stated that they will retaliate. What form that will take, we don't exactly know. But yes, this development with the nuclear deal, we have a statement out of the president's office, President Hassan Rouhani, saying they will no longer observe certain limits and restrictions on fuel enrichment, on the size of the enriched uranium stockpile. So it's not the death throes of the nuclear deal. They still say they will allow international inspectors to come in and look at nuclear sites, but it's certainly not good news for the future of the U.S. nuclear deal, which, of course, America has already pulled out of.
Mary Louise, does it feel to you like it's a country that is bracing for war?
We put that question to many people here today, and every single person we spoke to, some said, we're ready, we want war, bring it on. Some said, war is not a good thing, Iran wants peace. But everyone we spoke to said, if it comes, we will fight.
That is NPR's Mary Louise Kelly, one of the only American reporters in Tehran right now. Mary Louise, thank you so much and stay safe.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Let's turn now to the other flashpoint in this developing story, Baghdad, where General Soleimani was killed. President Trump is threatening Iraq with severe sanctions after the country's parliament voted to end the presence of American troops in the country in response to Soleimani's assassination. NPR's Jane Arraf joins us from Baghdad. And Jane, does the vote yesterday actually mean that American troops will be forced to leave?
It could well mean that. Essentially, it's not legally binding, but what it does is it directs the government to start the proceedings. And since the prime minister, Adel Abdel Mahdi, who's outgoing but still prime minister, endorsed the recommendation that the American troops leave, it actually carries a lot of weight. And in fact, he said he was starting the legal proceedings to make it happen.
Let's step back a little bit and talk about why the troops are there, which is really to help the Iraqis fight ISIS. The U.S. is now pulling back from that mission. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So Americans, as you know, came in to topple Saddam Hussein, and that was 16 years ago. Then they went through a long period of fighting an insurgency. Then there was al-Qaeda. And then the status of forces agreement, this agreement that the U.S. has with other countries, a lot of different countries, such as Bahrain, for instance, that expired. So there wasn't this big agreement that could allow them to bring in all these troops. The U.S. didn't want it. Iraq didn't want it. It just became complicated. So they signed these new agreements, and basically the forces that are here at the invitation of the Iraqi government. And they have quite a strict mandate. Their limited mandate is to help Iraqis fight ISIS. It's not to watch over Iran. It's not to do anything else. It is to help train Iraqi forces and to support them with air support, surveillance, intelligence in fighting ISIS. So that's what they have been doing here until yesterday, when the Americans announced that because of these increased threats, they were suspending all of those operations to focus on force protection here.
Can we talk a little bit about these U.S. sanctions against Iraq? Has there been any response to that from the Iraqi government?
There has not been a formal response, but certainly they would be worrying. The U.S. gets a waiver to be able to import Iranian electricity, for instance. It still doesn't have enough electricity. That waiver runs out fairly shortly and would have to be renewed. And then, as you've seen, President Trump is also talking about charging Iraqis for use of the air base that they are on, which is actually an Iraqi base. But the thing is, this is very much a political decision, and the people who want the U.S. troops out are even more emboldened by the threat of sanctions. A lot of politicians are saying, basically, yeah, bring on the sanctions. That's certainly not the way Iraqis feel. Iraqis have been through sanctions, and they are devastating. So that's a worry as well.
Mm-hmm. Can you step back and tell us why General Soleimani was actually in Baghdad?
Yeah. So General Qasem Soleimani was a frequent visitor to Baghdad. He had come to Iraq in the previous month something like 7 times as the government was trying to regenerate and politicians were trying to pick a new prime minister. Iran has been very heavily involved both on the security front and the political front. The morning that he came and the morning he was killed, though, according to the Iraqi prime minister and according to what he told parliament yesterday, he said that Qasem Soleimani had arrived, and he had arrived with an Iranian response, a letter, that he was going to deliver to the Iraqi prime minister in response to a Saudi peace proposal. He portrayed it as a bid to basically diffuse regional tension, but he said before that could happen, before he could receive the letter or meet Soleimani, the airstrike happened.
Hmm. What are you watching for as this crisis continues?
Gosh, yeah, it's really a multi-layered crisis. So one of the things is the rise in sectarian tension. And you'll probably remember the horrible images and the horrible times during the civil war here when Sunnis were fighting Shia. Mm-hmm. All of that tension had de-escalated. You know, it hasn't really been a factor. And we've seen it with the protest movement of hundreds of thousands of young people going out in the streets and saying, we don't care what religion you are, we're all Iraqi. When Parliament voted on whether to kick out U.S. troops, it was almost exclusively Shia members of Parliament, the Kurds and the Sunnis, who were terrified of the U.S. leaving generally, stayed away. So there's that. There's the rise of ISIS. There's what happens to this protest movement that had made some headway in demanding a more efficient, less corrupt government that served Iraqi interests and not Iranian or other interests. And then the sanctions, of course. There are a lot of things people here are worried about.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf in Baghdad. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
Days after dropping out of the presidential race, Julian Castro said today that he is endorsing Senator Elizabeth Warren's bid for the White House. Both Castro and Warren are known for their progressive policies on issues like health care that are popular with the Democratic base. Here's Warren talking about Medicare for All on CNN yesterday.
I want to get the maximum amount of help to the maximum number of people as quickly as possible. And the reason for that is people are suffering. 36 million Americans last year did not have a prescription filled that the doctor had written because they couldn't afford it.
To win the nomination, Warren and other progressive candidates will have to beat out more moderate candidates like Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg. Here's Buttigieg on CNN.
I'm running based on what's possible, a bold policy agenda that would make me the most progressive president we've had in a half century, that we can do in a way that will actually unify and not polarize more of the American people.
So what does history tell us about a party nominating a candidate from the base versus the middle? Joining us now to talk about that is Michael Kazin, who's a professor of history at Georgetown University, and he's working on a book about the history of the Democratic Party. Michael, welcome.
Great to be here.
Well, and when was the last time a candidate won the presidency by playing to the progressive part of the Democratic base the way Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are doing?
Probably going back to Lyndon Johnson in 1964.
Which followed the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Exactly. But really, Democrats win by coming up with policies and a message which is popular among not just the base, but among independent voters, swing voters as well.
Well, let's go back into history, starting with 1972, when Senator George McGovern lost to incumbent President Richard Nixon. Democrats are still referring to that loss in 2019. Why was that race so important that it still comes up today?
Well, it was so important because the party was really divided at that point. The major issue in the country at the time was the war in Vietnam. George McGovern, who won the nomination, was in favor of pulling out of Vietnam as soon as possible. Social movements were beginning to gain that had been inspired by the turmoil of the 60s, the gay rights movement, the feminist movement, some of the more radical parts of the African-American movement. And they were on McGovern's side, but that was not a majority of the country. And also, McGovern didn't seem as if he were a good candidate to reach the sort of more moderate swing voters. And Richard Nixon, the president, was very popular at the time, so it was hard to defeat a popular incumbent as it always is. But the problem with McGovern is that he appealed only to the activist sides of the Democratic Party, not to the sort of broad middle of the party.
Do you think that the party is as divided today?
I don't think so. I think in many ways, Democrats agree on some basic policies. Most Democrats, I think, agree on that everyone should be covered by health insurance, whether it should be partly private, partly public, or all public. They, I think, agree on protecting the right to abortion. They agree on more low-income housing, that kind of thing, and environmental protection. They want to help curb climate change. So really, many of the most important issues face the country, especially domestic issues, I think Democrats are broadly in agreement.
So after McGovern lost in 1972 and then Richard Nixon resigned, the party, the Democratic Party, nominated Jimmy Carter, an evangelical Christian who won a lot of states Democrats can't imagine winning today, including Texas, Mississippi, Alabama. Were those states part of the Democratic base at that point?
Some were, some were not. Lyndon Johnson, who was a Texan, of course, had kept Texas in the Democratic column when he ran for president in 64 and managed to pass it on to Hubert Humphrey, who got the nomination in 68. But, of course, the White South used to be the base of the Democratic Party. It was the only states Democrats could be assured of winning throughout the 19th century and much of the 20th century as well. But then when the Democratic Party turned around and became a very energetic supporter of rights for racial minorities, especially black people, that began to change. And of course, now most of the South is now, of course, solidly Republican.
Do you think that Jimmy Carter straddled both the base of the Democratic Party and some of those people who may now be Republicans?
Jimmy Carter was seen as more of a moderate, even conservative figure, I think. Mm-hmm. Carter was able to win really in large part because of Richard Nixon's resignation, because Gerald Ford pardoned him, and because the country was in economic trouble. Mm-hmm. Stagflation was a serious issue at the time. And so he won only narrowly, actually. And without those southern states, he would have lost to Gerald Ford. Ford won states now that Republicans can't imagine winning, like California.
Then in the 1980s, Democrats had some pretty unsuccessful nominees, Walter Mondale and Michael Dukakis. Who were they trying to appeal to, and why did they fail?
Well, they tried to straddle the center and the left of the party. They didn't do so very successfully. Mondale also, there was some disagreement on the left about his campaign. Jesse Jackson, the black activist who'd been very close to Martin Luther King Jr., ran an insurgent campaign in 1984. He also ran in 88. And Jackson really ran as an insurgent, as an outsider, as somebody who really wanted to shake up not just the elites in the country, but also to transform the party itself into a much more sort of grassroots party, a party that was going to serve people who had been, he thought, their concerns had not been in the center of party debate. And he did pretty well, actually, even though, of course, he didn't really come that close to getting the nomination. And in many ways, Sanders in 2016 and also this year is trying to do something very similar.
So when you get to 1992, Bill Clinton, the governor of Arkansas, wins the presidency on his Third Way platform. Again, we've got a situation where a Democrat that is more moderate ends up winning the presidency. Does that make the argument that many would make now that the moderate candidate is the better choice for Democrats if they want to win?
Again, context matters. Clinton, he was able to get the nomination because for a long time, many people thought George H.W. Bush could not be beaten, the incumbent president. And by the time Bush's polls began to go downward, Clinton was the most persuasive candidate in the race. And also, he showed he could win white and black votes, white votes in the South, like Jimmy Carter had, and also African-American votes. And that was a winning combination. So I think the fact he was a moderate, perceived as a moderate, was less important than the fact that he didn't have any very strong liberal competitors.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we remember that after Bill Clinton's two terms, Al Gore ran and won the popular vote, but lost the election just barely to George W. Bush. Would you have described him as a progressive at the time or a moderate?
I think Gore was running as a moderate. And he, of course, was running in a sense to give Bill Clinton a third term. So he clung as close to Clinton as he could, even though he tried to
distance himself to some degree.
Distance himself about the impeachment. And again, there was a pretty strong liberal candidate in that race in 2000, Bill Bradley. But Bradley really was not able to mobilize forces on the left the way Sanders and Warren are trying to do today.
And then what about President Obama? When he ran in 2008, I don't think most people would have considered him running on the progressive side of the Democratic Party a la Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders.
No, I think his rhetoric sounded progressive. He sounded like a movement leader. And so he really appealed to people on the left and a lot of people on the center, too. I knew lifelong Republicans who voted for him because mm-hmm. they liked his style. And also, again, don't forget that he ran during the beginning of the Great Recession, when arguably any Democrat could have won.
So as you look at the field right now of Democrats, I'm not going to ask you which one you would want, but which one do you think would have the best chance of winning the presidency if they become the nominee?
Let's do this again after Super Tuesday in March. Then I'll tell you.
There's so many of them at this point.
Well, in the long range, I think it really is going to be important for any Democrat who wins a nomination to reach the 8-10% of voters who really are swing voters. And what will attract them? Well, on the one hand, having an effective message saying that President Trump has betrayed the country, has not helped people he said he was going to help. But on the other hand, I think there has to be some sort of unifying message which will tell a lot of people who would like to vote for a Democrat but might not be core Democratic voters that their interests are going to be served. That can happen economically. It can happen by speaking about sort of gauzier, more general ideas of a more honest government. I'm not quite sure what message is going to be the most effective one, but I am sure that any Democrat who wins a nomination will not just be able to talk to their base, because their base isn't large enough to win the Electoral College. It might be large enough to win the popular vote, but probably not large enough to win the Electoral College.
I want to ask you one more question, which sort of goes off of our topic about the Democratic base. Let me ask you, what do you think of the fact that President Trump has spent so much time just focusing on his base and not really focusing on those voters who are in the middle?
I think President Trump and his advisors have made a very clever calculation, really, which is that they're probably not going to get a lot of voters outside their base because Trump is a very polarizing figure. And so they really need to boost turnout among white middle and white working class people.
Is that enough, though, to win the presidency?
It depends on which states they turn out in, of course, as we saw in 2016. It's certainly enough to win the South. Is it enough to win those key states in the upper Midwest, which made the difference in the election, and Pennsylvania? Not really sure. This is going to be an election in 2020. Most people predict that the bases on both sides will turn out in huge numbers. We could see voter turnout that we really haven't seen since the 1960s or even earlier. And if that happens, then it's going to be key, of course, how many people each base turn out. But it's also going to be key, again, who turns out enough people in that 8 to 10% in the middle to buttress the large turnout of the base.
That is Michael Kazin, who's a professor of history at Georgetown University, and he's working on a book right now about the history of the Democratic Party. Thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to do it. Thank you.
Well, what do you think? Would Democrats be better off nominating a more progressive candidate or a more moderate one if the goal is beating President Trump in November? We're at hereandnow.org. Do you feel you have more free time than you used to with all that technology that's supposed to make your life easier? Well, our next guest says the answer is probably no. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So you write that the household economy of cooking, cleaning, mending, washing, and grocery shopping has arguably changed more in the past 100 years than the American factory or the modern office. That was all stuff that was supposed to make our lives easier and give us more free time.
Yes. So cast our minds back 100 years ago to 1920 or just earlier. The home is practically prehistoric in terms of its technology. The vast majority of houses in America have no electricity, few have plumbing, and the average housewife is working about 50 hours a week. In the next half century, you have the introduction of air conditioning, toilets, refrigerators, freezers, electric irons, vacuum cleaners, and all this labor-saving technology saves exactly zero hours of labor. Housewives are still working 50 hours a week. That's according to the economist Juliette Shore, according to her book, The Overworked American. And I see this story of the housewife in the 20th century as the perfect microcosm for the entire economy when asking this question, why don't we have more leisure time? In the last 100 years, tech has changed so much, but the time we spend working hasn't really changed that much at all. Once again, all this labor-saving tech hasn't actually saved that much labor.
Why is that? Why don't we have more free time?
I think a big part of this is that better technology raises our expectations, and higher expectations themselves creates more work. So, for example, automatic washers and dryers, they raise our expectations for clean clothes. They encourage people to, you know, go out and buy new shirts and pants. Well, that means that housewives have to do more loads of laundry to wash and fold and dry. You could say the same thing about refrigerators. They make it easier to keep our food fresh. But housewives in the 1940s, 1950s used that convenience to spend more time driving to the supermarket to buy fresh produce or stock the fridge. So as the tech of the home increased, so did our expectations of how spiffy and clean and delicious our home life should be. And as a result, it didn't save that much labor.
So what are we supposed to do with this information, Derek? Or are you just giving us another thing to worry about, that we'll have to download an app that's supposed to fix it but won't actually fix it?
It's a very good question. So I think that some of the reasons why we tend to work so much have to do with individual expectations rising, but some of it has to do with who our boss is. Women for a long time, even those who wanted to work, couldn't because they were under the thumb of their husbands. Then they went into the labor force, the 1960s, 1970s, and as a result, they reduced their home cleaning time, their housewifing time. And I think that that's an interesting metaphor for the entire economy, that technology only frees people from work if the boss or the government or the economic system allows it to. Tech on its own does not create more leisure time. Tech plus decisions made at a national level can create more leisure time. So if we do as a population, as a country, in a democracy, as your previous guest was saying, if we demand from our political leaders more leisure time because of our technology, we can do it. But we can't say that it's all on us. It's also on our leaders to write rules that create more time for us to be leisurely.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, and we will link you to more of his reporting on this research at hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Do you remember middle school? What a time. Kids at that age aren't quite children, but they're also far from being adults, and they're dealing with everything from growing pains to hormones. And these days, they're also grappling with weighty issues like climate change and gun violence. School counselors are often on the front lines in helping young people manage feelings of stress and anxiety. And so we thought, why not ask one of the top counselors in the nation for her advice on how to address all of this as we settle into the new year? Joining us now is Laura Ross, a counselor at Five Forks Middle School in Lawrenceville, Georgia. And she's also the American School Counselor Association's Counselor of the Year. Laura, welcome and congratulations on this honor.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on your show today.
Well, first, you were named School Counselor of the Year for your leadership, collaboration, and advocacy. And I'm actually reading an example about your work to decrease discipline referrals. You noticed that Black and Latino boys at your school made up 49% of referrals, and you were able to get those down in 1 year by 32%. What was your strategy, and how did you do that?
We had for a couple of years worked with supporting those students in small groups to help deal with whatever challenges they're facing, setting some goals so they have a positive direction to go. But we realized that we have to be more encompassing of everybody in the school building and making sure that those supports are there. And so really making sure that our staff are really paying attention to their own implicit bias and really understanding how to be culturally responsive in their classrooms and in working with our students. We have a very diverse student population and our staff isn't as diverse. And so we're all working with students who have different experiences and different backgrounds from us and really understanding how to connect with our students, be culturally responsive to them, and also being aware of our implicit bias and how that can kind of sneak in to our day-to-day practices in our teaching and our interactions with students. And if we're aware of them, then we can kind of interrupt those and make sure that we are making decisions that are equitable across the board for all students.
One thing that's really interesting about your background is that you worked at an adult men's correctional facility. I'm just really curious about what you learned from that experience and if it's been helpful in counseling children.
Absolutely. It really is kind of the reason why I became a school counselor. So I was a social work major, and I worked, interned at the correctional facility and then worked 2 years there afterwards as one of the counselors and also security threat group coordinator, which meant I helped to identify members of hate groups and gangs. And so most of my caseload ended up being gang members. And they, working with those men, some of the most, still the most intelligent, talented, charismatic people that I've worked with. But as I talked with them, what I learned from just story after story is that they just had no connection to school. They didn't really have anybody in their family or community where that was what they did, is they graduated high school and were successful and maybe pursued further education. And they also didn't feel connected to school. They all, a lot of them expressed that wasn't a place where they belonged, and nobody kind of really cared if they were there or not. But yet they had so many strengths that had they really connected to their education, I think could have provided some great positive opportunities for them. So I knew that I had to get into schools and start working with these guys as they were younger. And so that's really how I ended up becoming a school counselor, is I wanted to make sure that I was in schools and connecting with students and connecting them to their education so that they could see, you know, how it they related to their education and how that could help them and have positive opportunities in the future with their education as well.
What a decision you made there. And it really goes back to the importance of middle school counselors, because I'm thinking about high school counselors. When I think about my high school counselors, I think about college stuff. We were going through college applications, very like administrative type things. But middle school is when you're really at the point where you're either turning on or turning off from school. And there are all of those social emotional issues. Can you talk a little bit more about why it's so crucial to have counseling staff at that particular age?
Sure. You know, I've even seen it in late elementary school. I used to be an elementary school counselor, but kind of that fifth grade year, and maybe even fourth grade, but definitely as they're rolling into middle school, is seeing students kind of lose that self-confidence or just feeling that they were adequate to achieve and be successful. And so that becomes a part of it. But also in middle school, you know, that's the social piece is so important, and trying to figure out how to be your own self and be you, but also you want to fit in as well. And so we see students who that's a struggle for them. And so really finding their place of sort of that self-awareness and having that self-confidence, but also the social awareness and perspective taking and sort of interacting with diverse peers, and then responsible decision-making, all of those things sort of combine together. And some of that is in their social emotional development, and some of it overlaps with their goals for the future and post-secondary readiness, and some of it overlaps with their academic performance. And so having school counselors those are the three domains that we really are supporting students in, and really being there to help them sort of not telling them what to do, but just helping guide them and being that sounding board for them and helping them sort of even reframe and start to see themselves more positively and have more confidence so that they can interact positively with peers and they can make good decisions about their academics, the extracurriculars, and their working with others. So yeah. We kind of have a hand in all of that in middle school that then kind of helps them be prepared to then make that leap into high school and that journey into figuring out what to do after high school college or beyond, career, yeah. Whatever they yep. choose to do.
I understand that your load at your school is at about 600 students per counselor, and the American School Counselor Association recommends about 250-1 student to counselor ratio. So you guys have a big job. I mean, you're dealing with a lot of students day in and day out. If there were three things that you were going to say to parents and loved ones to help support the work that you do so that we can raise students who are mentally healthy and secure and really focused on learning, what would you tell us?
You know, I think first and foremost that school counselors are here to be an integral part of your students' education. Some students we are providing small group support for, but just know that this is about sort of the whole child well-being. And so when a school counselor is working with your student, it is not something's wrong with your student. We just want to make sure that every student has all the supports that they need to be successful. Mm-hmm. You know, two, I think that a big thing is just listening and being open to what your child is sharing. It's a hard time because it's middle school, and so they want to kind of pull away from parents a little bit. But also when they do share, or share with a counselor and the counselor helps them share with a parent, just know that, you know, their feelings, their thoughts, and what they're dealing with are true for them at that time. And so that's their reality. And so we want to help them through that the best way possible. And so I think really just listening to the voice of our students and in our children to make sure that they do really feel heard and feel supported. And then third, I just think that being a team member with the school, then the school working with parents, I mean, we all have to kind of be that team together to support students. We all want what's best for our students and our kids. And so just to make sure that we're all communicating and working together and deciding really what's best for that student so that they can be successful. So just keeping those communication lines open.
Laura Ross is a counselor at Five Forks Middle School in Lawrenceville, Georgia. She is also the American School Counselor Association's Counselor of the Year. Laura, congrats again, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
Let's get back to our top story, the situation with Iran. I spoke today with Chuck Hagel, former Republican senator and Secretary of Defense under President Obama, and I began by asking him if he thought President Trump's decision to kill Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was a mistake.
Well, I have not seen the intelligence, obviously, but yes, Soleimani was an enemy of the United States, was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of Americans. At the same time, there's always a smart way and a not-so-smart way to deal with these things. And I'm not sure, from what I've seen the last few days, this administration had any strategy. Where's this going? What about second and third-order consequences? So, you know, we'll see how this plays out. But right now, it looks like Iran is the big winner. I mean, go to the Iraqi parliament's actions yesterday, voting to expel the United States from Iraq. If that occurs, that's a huge defeat for us and a big win for Iran. I mean, that has consequences all over the Middle East. ISIS and all our other allies in the Middle East would be affected by that. So that's the way I would answer your question.
Well, did you ever consider killing Soleimani when you were Secretary of Defense? Because it's been reported that this has been something that's been thought of for many years, but nobody's ever actually done it.
Well, you always have contingencies and options, especially on people with profiles like Soleimani. But again, those contingencies and options have to be thought through and carefully analyzed. There's no guarantee in anything you do. First of all, you want some specific strategy behind it. What is really the purpose other than just killing the guy? And it always should fit into what I think is a diplomatic strategic objective. If it doesn't fit that diplomatic strategic objective, then I think it's very questionable whether you do it or not.
Well, the Trump administration would say that the objective was to stop Soleimani from killing any more Americans.
Well, then I heard Secretary Pompeo say yesterday the objective was deterrence. So which is it? And we haven't seen the intelligence. Now, I'm probably not going to see it, but members of Congress, I saw Adam Schiff, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, on television yesterday, and he said it doesn't live up to the administration's claim. So we need a lot more clarity on this, and that's another aspect of this. The Congress is completely vacant in this. And that's not the way the Constitution is supposed to work. That's not the way it does work. Article 1 of the Constitution is the Congress. It's supposed to be three co-equal branches of government.
Well, if Congress, as expected, votes this week, the House anyway, on a resolution to limit President Trump's ability to conduct military action against Iran, is that the right approach, do you think, on the part of the House?
Well, I've been one who has favored for many years bringing up the use of military force resolution that we passed back in 2001, and then we amended it somewhat in 2002. We've got to renew that because it is so wide open now, and it's not even relevant to today, 2020. So I've been in favor of Senator Kaine and others' resolutions to update that use of military force to bring the Congress more into it.
Well, do you think that the killing of Soleimani was legal?
Well, it depends on what your interpretation is. Now, the United Nations has said it was a violation of human rights. He was a member of a foreign nation, sovereign nation's government. Baghdadi and all the rest were terrorists. And so the United Nations already said it was illegal. He's an enemy of the United States. I mean, there is a strong case to be made for that. But the point is that it was a targeted hit, very targeted. Plus, the other part of this that doesn't get a lot of attention, it's getting attention in Iraq, and that is the other general that was killed alongside Soleimani, an Iraqi. The United States is supposed to abide by the agreement it has with the Iraqi government, that the Iraqi government would sign off on any combat actions and missions that the United States would take. Well, that obviously didn't occur.
The Trump administration has said that they want to de-escalate the situation. What would you advise if the goal is to de-escalate the situation?
Well, I know what they've said about de-escalation, but I don't see in their words or deeds any de-escalation. I see nothing but escalation. I mean, you're sending more than 4,000 more troops over there. You've been sending thousands more last year. I mean, that's not de-escalation. One of the things you could do to de-escalate is for the president to stop tweeting and talking about we're going to hit 52 Iranian sites, some of them cultural, historical cultural events, which would, in fact, would be illegal. And stop baiting the Iranians like that. That'd be a good start.
That is former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel. You can hear more of our conversation elsewhere in the program today and at hereandnow.org, including Hagel's thoughts on why the situation in Iran should not delay the impeachment trial.
We're the greatest nation on earth. Come on. We can't walk and chew gum at the same time. I don't think you can stop these things. I mean, again, that's a victory for Iran. I mean, I think the rest of the world would look at us and laugh.
That's at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.